Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, June 25th, 2017. This is episode 1399. Enjoy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches, you know, anything with a chip in it. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's my phone number. Gosh, I say that fast. 888, I'm not an auctioneer. I should really say that a little more slowly. 888-827-5536. That's toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. or if you're in Canada. Outside those areas, you can still call, but you can't call with your phone. You have to use some sort of voice over the internet that can dial phone numbers in the U.S. And I'll leave that as an exercise to the listener as to how to do that. Skype, if you have Skype out, that'll do it. That's an example. 8888-ASK-LEO. I'm back. I was on vacation. I know. Thanks again to Scott Wilkinson for filling in for me last Sunday. Hope you enjoyed that show. But I can answer all the questions now if you've been holding on to them. The website is techguylabs.com. While I was gone, somebody sent me an email, or maybe sent it to the company and said, you shouldn't let Leo, I am the company, so I don't know, I got it. You shouldn't let Leo go on vacation when there's an Apple event. Don't you think Leo wasn't happy about it? Unfortunately, Apple doesn't tell you there's an Apple event till about 1 week before the Apple event. I'm afraid I have to plan my vacation a little better than that. So I was, in fact, flying to Miami during the Apple event on June 5th, 20 days ago. It's an interesting experience because the plane didn't have Wi-Fi. To be completely out of communication. There aren't many places anymore on the earth you can be that way, right? Completely out of communication. The plane lands. First thing I do, wheels hit the ground. I turn on the phone and say, quick, what did Apple say? And they kind of surprised me. I mean, I have to admit, they announced some things I didn't expect. They didn't do some things I thought they would, for instance, kill the MacBook Air. I thought, well, that's history, right? But no, they didn't do that. For some reason, they're still selling that. They did announce the new iPad, which we'd been waiting for since September of last year. The rumor was really strong that Apple was working on a 10.5-inch iPad. Apple didn't release it until now. Now, they released it right away, and in fact, I got it while I ordered it from the plane. Apple makes it way too easy to buy stuff with Apple Pay. Before I'd even gotten off the plane, I had ordered the new 10.5-inch iPad. At no small expense, I might add, these aren't cheap. And I've had it now for a little more than a week, so I just wanted to give you kind of my take on this. And it's, as everybody has said so far, you know, when you pick, if you have an iPad of any ilk, even the, almost even going back to the original iPad, and you pick it up, you probably say, well, yeah, that's very familiar. It's an iPad. I get it. Doesn't look that different. The operating system's changed, and if you have an original iPad, you can't use the new operating system, so that will look different. But other than that, if you have an iPad Air, you might say, and this is one of the reasons I think iPads aren't selling all that well anymore. People, these last 5, 6, 10 years, we don't know, and they last a long time, and people are happy, and they go, I don't need a new one, unless you drop it, screen breaks or something, you know, it's fine, if you have one, and lots of people have them. So Apple did a few things that are, you know, on the surface, incremental, what we call incremental improvements, you know, the minor improvements. They put finally a decent camera in. It's always bugged me that they, I guess I sound a little bit paradoxical here, because on the one hand, I think it's really dumb when I see people take pictures with a tablet, especially if you're in an event and they're holding up a big old tablet and you can't see around it. And it just looks dopey. And yet I see it a lot. So it kind of bugged me that Apple never put a decent camera in their iPads. Well, they have now. The camera in the new iPad Pros, the 10.5-inch and the 12.9, is the same camera as in the iPhone 7. It's their latest camera. It doesn't have the dual lenses of the 7 Plus, but it's a very, very good camera. And, you know, I might have to moderate my disdain for people who use tablets to take pictures, especially video, because what a great viewfinder, right? You're seeing the picture practically the size it is. So it's really high quality image. And by the way, this new iPad screen, remarkable. They've done a lot to make this screen more accurate, richer colors. And you don't notice it if you just hold it by itself, but if you put it next to an older iPad, I put it next to last year's iPad Mini. And it was noticeable. Much richer, deeper colors, more saturation. It's a very nice screen. But one more thing. It's a snappy processor. Snappy. The A10X is notably faster. In fact, some wag at one of the magazines decided to do a benchmark comparing this new iPad Pro 10.5 to a MacBook Pro 13-inch, the latest model. And in some respects, it's faster. It's actually faster than a MacBook, MacBook Pro, which tells you something. It's definitely faster than the MacBook, easily. It tells you that Apple sees the new iPads and as really the future of computing, I think. They're really pushing these as a replacement for your laptop. And putting all that speed in kind of confirms that. But really, and I don't know if I could take credit for this. I think I have to give credit to my friend Rene Ritchie, who writes for a Mac blog called iMore.com, because he was the first to observe that what you're really looking at, there are a couple. This iPad, as it is today, pretty much like any other iPad. But what you're really looking at is Apple doubling down on the future in a couple of ways. They announced they're going to update the operating system, iOS 11, this fall, to include, especially on these iPads, more desktop computing features. You'll have a dock you can, like that on the Macintosh, you can use to launch applications and it hides. And you'll have drag and drop. You'll even have a file manager, which lets you, in a limited way, look at the file contents of the iPad, something no one's ever been able to do before, but that's something a computer user wants. So that's one thing. The other thing Renee pointed out is, well, with this processor, this camera, this screen, Apple's making a product for augmented reality. And that also, Apple has said many times, Tim Cook has said it many times, the CEO of Apple, is the future for Apple. They want you to be able to hold up an iPad, use the very high quality camera to point it at the real world, and then have developers be able to interact with the real world, placing objects, 3D objects, in the real world. IKEA has already announced they're going to do this so you can see what that IKEA bedroom set will look like in your bedroom. You know, you just hold up the iPad, look at your bedroom through the camera, and then press a button and the IKEA furniture is there and you can move it around. And it looks like it's really there. You can walk around it. You can go behind it. You can move it up and down and it really looks like it's there. And to that end, Apple released some software at the developers conference in, you know, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Called AR Kit, Augmented Reality Kit, that makes it very easy for developers to do this. In fact, there have already been a number of demo programs that have come out. Like this is dopey, but a fidget spinner. You know those spinner things? You point the iPad at your coffee table, and you press a button, and a fidget spinner appears, and you can spin it on the screen, and it looks like it's spinning on your coffee table. Okay, that is not a good example, because that's the most trivial use. But maybe the IKEA example is a little bit better. And there's a lot more to come. So now we kind of a little bit understand, compared to, say, Microsoft, Apple's vision for augmented reality. And I think that's really what the iPad's telling us, is where Apple plans to go. The iPad, as it stands today, looks just like any other iPad. But what the iPad tells us is two big things about Apple's future. One, computing's moving to the tablet, for sure, and away from the Macintosh. And two, they have big plans for augmented reality that looks very different from all these other guys who are making the visors and the things you have to wear. And I'm not sure I'd bet against Apple's plan. I think it's a pretty good idea. All right, that's my sermon for Sunday. Now let's go to the phones. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Are you a little burned?
I'm just just nicely glowing.
Yeah, a little red. Maybe it's the camera.
Yes, that's what it
You've
is.
You've been in the sun, but that's good. You should enjoy the sun.
I've got a lot of time on my hands. I've been enjoying the pool.
Good. That's what you should do. That's actually what you should do. So you have been here laboring since early in the
welcome
morning.
Welcome back, by the way.
Thank you.
Your trip thank looked you. Amazing based on the thank photos.
You. Yeah, I posted photos in a few places. I guess the best place to go is my blog, leolaporte.com. And there's a sway. I use this Microsoft slideshow thing, which was probably a huge mistake because there's no, it turns out, I've been looking, there's no way to export it like to a movie or to anywhere else. So as long, I mean, it's okay as long as Microsoft keeps sway alive, but who knows? Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's a temporary thing, but you can find it at leolaporte.com. A little slideshow of my trip.
Well, we'll just continue that conversation because Alan in Santa Rosa is actually going to the Galapagos.
Oh, the lucky dog.
And he's talked to you before about it, I think, but he has some questions on photography.
Thank you. Well, that's...
So you'll know all about it.
I won't be able to shut up. Thank you, Kim. And hello, Alan. Let's see. Let me make sure I push the right button. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Alan.
Hey, Leo. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be back, believe it or not. That's the best thing about travel. You probably know you're a traveler. It makes you appreciate your home.
It's fun to get home, but it's fun to be abroad, too.
Yep. I kind of like both.
Yeah. I came in for the first time to the studio a couple of months ago, and we talked about the fact that you were going and I was going, and I didn't catch your show yesterday, so I don't know if you commented on it, and I'm just going to your leolaporte.com to look at your photos.
We don't expect you to hear every darn show. Well, I do.
But I'm a wide-angle kind of person. I do panoramic photography. I used to have film noblex and round shots. So I don't have any long lenses in my arsenal. And I wanted to find out about the nature photography in Galapagos. How long a lens did you use? Where, you know, what focal lengths were most of your shots taken at?
You want a good zoom. You know, one of the things, I had the same question before I went is, well, I heard the animals walk right up to you. They don't walk right up to you. maybe they used to walk right up to you. They're not particularly afraid of you. You're encouraged not to approach them. The Galapagos is highly protected, and it's a national park of Ecuador. And the rule is that you can't touch the animals, you can't interact with them, and you must stay 6 feet away from them. Now, I had one instance where a giant tortoise actually started coming for me, and I didn't know what to do, so I shouted, "You're always you cannot go alone, by the way. You're always accompanied by a trained guide from the Park Service." I shouted, "What do I do?" And she said, "Just freeze, don't move." So I didn't move, and the tortoise, which can't really see or hear very well, only can feel vibrations, just walked right by me. The funny thing there is, I had a very long lens because I was taking telephoto pictures. I carried with me a 70 to 200 lens for my Canon 5D, and with it a 2x extender. So most of the time, I was shooting 150 to 400.
Wow. Okay.
And the sad thing is that this tortoise walked right up to me, and there was no way I could get a shot because he was next to me, and I had this super long lens on. Most of the time, though, for birds, and there's a lot of seabirds. You spend a lot of time in the Galapagos, at least we did, and I think this is pretty common, on little rubber Zodiac boats sailing around. And you get amazing views of seabirds, the blue-footed boobies, the famous frigate birds, the penguins, but they're not that close. And a long lens is very helpful. Lisa brought her much more portable Olympus OMD, which she really loves, and is a great camera for this kind of thing. And she had a 14-150, but remember that's a crop lens, micro four thirds. So that's effectively 1.6 more.
Double.
Yeah, it's almost double. Yeah, or I guess MFT is double. You're right. So she had even 28-300. So she had she got a lot of great shots too. So I'll tell you, she was lucky because she had a zoom that could go from wide to long. I carried with me some interchangeable lenses. I did bring my my 16-35, very wide angle. And there were many times when that was a great camera to have. But I think ideally you'd want something with like a big zoom range.
Well, what I've done, since I didn't want to I didn't know what I would actually want long-term in long lenses. I've got reserved a rental of the Sony RX10 III, which is
nice
24
camera.
To 600.
That's perfect. That's what you want. Okay. That is a great camera. Sony's done a very good job with it. It's a one-inch sensor, so it's a very good quality image. And it's a point-and-shoot, but you have that range. That, I think, would be the ideal Galapagos camera. And many's the time I wish I hadn't, somebody's saying, this is why photographers have multiple cameras. I wasn't going to walk around. There's a lot of hiking. And you're in a boat, and you get wet in the Zodiac and all sorts. I wasn't going to carry a bunch of cameras, although sure would have been nice to have a second camera with a wider lens on it for that tortoise. But a lot of it, I kind of want to also say that best thing to do is to look and be there and be present rather than shooting stuff. On the other hand, having these pictures now, after the fact, really makes me happy because I can relive that experience. It is a marvelous place because it's as close as you can get on this planet to a place untouched by humans. And you really feel back like you've gone back in time.
Wow, looking forward to it. I can also shoot video with that camera, 4K.
And you will want to. You will want to.
And I'm bringing an action camera and a gimbal to be able to shoot that. And also when we go snorkeling to go underwater.
Yeah, bring underwater housing. I wish I'd had an underwater camera because the fish, are as varied as any tropical paradise. I mean, and they come from all different parts of the world. You see a remarkable array of fish underwater. And not to mention the beautiful manta rays, a wide variety of sharks. The seals are down there. The sea turtles are down there. You will be the starfish that look like cupcakes are down there. You will be amazed by what you see. It's quite beautiful.
Great. Well, yeah. I'm going to got your blog on. I'm looking at the photos now, and I'll...
You're going to have a wonderful time. You're going to have a...
Exactly.
I'm dying now to go back. It's just...
It
is... Well, it's almost a spiritual experience. You really... you go there and you feel a part of nature and you really see creation. It's beautiful. It's really beautiful. So have a one. When are you going?
We leave, July 12th, my wife.
Have a wonderful time.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And welcome back.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, for me, I love to travel, but a lot of, for me, travel is about photography. And I was really debating whether to bring these big, heavy cameras and lenses. I brought way too much gear. And I think a good point-and-shoot like that Sony RX3 is a very, very good RX100 or RX10, I guess he's bringing. Very, very good choice. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. James in San Francisco. Leo Laporte. Whoa. Hold on. What did I do? I pushed the wrong button. I failed. Oh, I'm sorry, James. Call back. I'll get you on. I pushed twice. I pushed twice. Instead, I've got, is it Mycel on from Fallbrook?
Yeah, it's me, Misael.
Misael. Hi, Misael.
Hi, Leo. I got a quick question for you. I got an iPhone 6 Plus, and, I broke my screen on it, and just wanted to ask you, how easy do you think it would be for me to switch it myself?
Not at all easy. First of all, the problem is getting the part. Apple doesn't want you to have the part. So that's part one. And then part two, it does require some... the 6 Plus is easier, let's put it this way. It's easier than the 7.
Okay.
I would go... here's what I would do. I would go to ifixit.com and take a look at their repair manual for the iPhone 6. They'll describe the tools you need. They even sell... If the part's available, they will sell the part. They certainly sell all the tools, and they sell parts for most things. Apple's funny, though. They don't remind me, does the 6 have the fingerprint, the Touch ID fingerprint reader? It does.
Touch ID.
So one of the things Apple has a problem with is in order to replace the screen, you're going to replace the Touch ID fingerprint reader and a secure store. And so Apple disables Touch ID on a third-party repair. They want to do it because in their opinion, that's the only way you can keep that secure. And they've really, I have to say, at last count, I think it was 12 states trying to pass right-to-repair legislation. It's not just Apple stuff. It's all kinds of stuff. And really, in many of the states are farm states. And John Deere is the most notorious offender here. They won't let you fix a John Deere tractor. And a lot of farmers would like to. John Deere's position is, well, we got proprietary software on these. I mean, these tractors aren't just, you know, they're not just your riding lawnmower here. These are giant combines and harvesters that have some very sophisticated autopilot software in there. And they're afraid that if they allow people into these, they'll steal the stuff. So you have to bring it to a John Deere repair person, and you have to have it certified, or you repair it and you have to have it certified. And there's all sorts of hoops to jump through. So there's a considerable lobby to change the laws to require these companies to offer parts and manuals. Apple's lobbying very hard in each of these states to keep these laws off the books. They would, you know, and it's like John Deere, you can kind of understand their point. So I don't know how the people who repair iPhones get the parts. They're not buying them from Apple. I suspect what they're doing is they're buying used phones and disassembling them. But Apple certainly doesn't publish the manuals, how-tos, information, sell the parts, sell the tools. And in the back of the Apple store, there are all these purpose-built machines, I'm told. I've never been back there, but I'm told by those who have, designed to disassemble Apple gear. You know, special boxes and things. Special tools. And Apple, you know, this goes back to the very earliest days of Apple. Steve Wozniak, the designer of the Apple I and Apple II computer, believed, as many of us do, that computers and technology and devices of all kinds should be open, repairable. People should be able to hack with them. That's where innovation happens. Steve Jobs hated that idea. He said, no, these should be sealed units. He wasn't able to persuade Woz for the Apple I and II, but by the time the Macintosh came around, Steve Jobs had his way. The Macintosh was manufactured with special screws that at the time required a very rare and unusual kind of screwdriver called a Torx screwdriver to open up. You weren't supposed to open it up. You were supposed to bring it to Apple to open it up. And it's only gotten worse since then. If you go to iFixit, ifixit.com, specializes in making it easy and teaching people how to repair stuff. And what they do now is they tear stuff down to figure out how it's put together. They also give it a score, what they call the repairability score. And they count, you know, things against you that make it hard to repair. For instance, as more and more manufacturers glue things together instead of screwing them together, that really reduces their repairability because it's hard to take apart things that are glued together without breaking them. So I'm just going to visit iPhone 6, the iPhone 6 page at iFixit. You have a 6 Plus, but it will be similar. Let me just see what their repairability score. 7 out of 10. That's good. The latest iPhones, 9 out of, or as, I think close to 1 out of 10. 7 out of 10 is very good. So I think, and you'll see they have how to replace the screen. And they may even have parts there. This is a great place to start anyway, to see, first of all, what it takes to repair it and decide for yourself whether you have the will to do it. I understand, I guess, that companies, you know, here's Apple's example for the fingerprint, the Touch ID. They say, look, once you take the screen and the Touch ID are mated. When you replace one, you replace the other. And once you do that, you compromise the secure store where this identity information is stored. Now, at that point, we can't guarantee that that's going to be secure. In fact, there was a Apple said it was a bug. Some said it was intentional. There was a software flaw in iOS that if you did do this, the whole phone bricked. It crashed and was unusable. Apple apologized and fixed that once people discovered it. I would say it's a good idea to encourage with your dollars these companies to make these devices more repairable, because more repairable also means less landfill. As it stands now, if an iPhone is dead, all you can do is bring it to Apple and get a new one. Apple makes a big deal about recycling, but we don't know how much stuff actually gets recycled. Remember, they showed off a robot named Liam that could take apart an iPhone. That's very nice, but how many Liams are there? And how many iPhones are taken apart and reused? And how many of them make it in the landfill? That's a big question. So encourage companies, I think, with your dollars and with your votes and with your emails and letters, to make stuff repairable, to make it open enough so that third parties can repair it. This is a good thing. And then, you know, buy stuff that can be repaired. We don't live in a world, we're just talking about the Galapagos and the impact of humanity. We don't live in a world where we could just throw this stuff in the landfill anymore. We got to repair it. We got to reuse it. We got to recycle it. It's really important. James, San Francisco, thanks for hanging on. I apologize for hanging up on you. Leo Laporte.
It's okay, Leo. I call you my tech guru.
Well, I'm glad you called. What can I do for you, my son?
I've been thinking about buying a Chromebook, fairly inexpensive, $200, $250. But I've also noticed in the recent past there have been some inexpensive laptops that have a Windows 10 installed. And I know you've warned us against getting these really cheap laptops, but what do you think? I do want to do some recording. I'm a musician, and if I were on a Chromebook, are there online?
Yes. Yeah, there are. Hang on for a second. This is a good question, because I am a fan of Chromebooks, but there are also things you need a general purpose computer to do. But okay. What's amazing is how much you can do these days with just Chrome OS. But hang on, we got to take a break. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I don't mean to rag on Apple alone, by the way. I just got the new Microsoft Surface laptop, the one with the Alcantara fabric around the keyboard. And iFixit tore this down. They said, there's no way you can repair this laptop without removing the fabric first. That's the only way you can get into it. There's no screws on the back. It's all underneath the fabric, and there's no way to remove the fabric without tearing it, which means there's no way to repair this, because they don't, you know, you can't replace the fabric. So there are lots of companies making devices that are not recyclable. It's not just Apple. Anyway, we were talking to James. James has an interesting conundrum. He does audio editing, and he is needing a new computer. He's tempted to buy an inexpensive Chromebook, which I recommend for many people. And you don't, I should point out, James, I don't recommend Chromebooks just for price alone. In fact, not really for price at all, but because they're simpler, more secure systems that will do most of what most people want to do. In fact, all of what most people want to do, but not all of what necessarily you want to do. So one way to test this is, you can do it right now with any computer you have, is just say, well, I'm going to only use Chrome and see how much I can do. There are audio editors for Chrome. There are photo editors for Chrome. Some of them are quite good. Polar with two R's is a Lightroom-like or a Photoshop-like.
What about recording? Recording an instrument?
That's a good, really good question. I would guess not to the quality you would like. And any laptop that's running a general purpose operating system, Macintosh, Windows, or Linux, has a variety of great recording tools. So I think that might be an example of where you're doing something specialized enough that you do need a full operating system.
Okay.
Now, I would be careful about getting the Windows laptops that are too cheap. We've seen this before with netbooks. When the price gets that low, they really compromise on components and quality. The screens are terrible. I understand budget considerations, but spend as much as you can anyway to get as good a laptop. And there are good Windows laptops under $500, absolutely.
Can I say one more thing, Leo?
Sure, James.
You write well, and I'd like to see you expand on your trip. I didn't see very much, you know, the written word.
No, it's mostly just pictures.
If you could make time, it would be
thank
interesting.
Thank you. I'm flattered. Thank you, James. I hate writing. I hate it. I've written 13 books, and I hate it. It's the most, I don't know why, it's just very painful to me. Maybe because I spent my life talking. And the nice thing about talking, especially the way I do it live, is there's no editing. There's no taking it back. If you can, the demands are lighter.
That's why 11 a.m. Saturday and Sunday is appointment podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate it. You're very kind, James. Thank you. Take care. I like Chromebooks a lot. I really do. And for students, I think they're a great solution. But you should test. Before you get a Chromebook, you should see, can I do everything I want to do in Chrome? The newer Chromebooks also support the Android Play Store and many Android apps. And, of course, there are lots of music apps, recording apps on Android. There's a very good, I can't remember what the name of it is. There's a very good, was it Auphonic? Auphonic. That comes to mind. There's a very good Android app. Yeah, I think it is the Auphonic Editor that lets you do post-production on a server. So you can record using your phone. The audio goes up to Auphonic servers, and then they can do a lot of processing and all sorts of stuff. It's free for 2 hours of audio a month. And this, I'm pretty sure this works. They have desktop apps and they have mobile apps, but I'm pretty sure it also works on the web. So I would go to Auphonic, Auphonic.com, and see what they can do. And if that's kind of along the lines of what you need, that's really the only way to know, unfortunately. If a Chromebook can do what you need to do, is just try to do what you want to do in a browser. I'm, for instance, very intrigued with this new iPad and the power in the new iPad and a number of really good photo apps that are starting to come out for the iPad, including Affinity, which is a very nice photo editor from the Serif guys, the guys who created Serif, which is also very good. And, of course, Adobe is more and more making Photoshop and Lightroom on the iPad more and more like its desktop apps. I'm very intrigued if in my next trip, instead of bringing a laptop, if I can do all the photo processing and everything I need to do, including blogging and posting, from an iPad. It sure would be nice just to carry this little, you know, pound and a half device instead of a big old laptop. Look at this. Marsworm has given us a great link, and we will we'll put this in the show notes at techguylabs.com, from midnightmusic.com to music software for Chromebooks. And then he also gave us a link to a Reddit thread in audio engineering on DAWs, which is digital audio workstations, and sequencers on Chrome OS. And it sounds like there are things you can do. So it depends on whether it's adequate to your needs. But we'll put both of those links for you, James, in the show notes at techguylabs.com. I'm always keeping the back of my mind. Well, if I retire from radio, if I can't talk for a living anymore, my voice goes, or I for whatever reason can't sit up for 3 hours at a time, maybe I'll do more writing. So I should probably keep my writing chops up there. It's just painful for some reason. I don't know why. I think it's the editing. If I could just talk and transcribe it, that would do. It's then going back and fixing it. Hey, let's go all the way to Denmark. Jasper's on the line. Hi, Jasper.
Hello, Leo. Welcome. How are you doing?
I am great. Isn't this funny? This sounds so much better with Skype from Denmark than any old normal phone call. You sound fantastic.
Thank you. It's actually not Skype. You recommend Skype, but I'm using Google Hangout because that was for free for me.
Google Hangouts too? Yeah. Wow, yeah. That's nice.
So I have a mobile question for you. I'm guessing it's my Wi-Fi on my OnePlus 3 is giving me hiccups.
Uh-oh.
It seems like it has a hard time connecting to my Wi-Fi because it has a lag, and sometimes the apps are not responding and gives me a sort of timeout error. What I've done
Do you have this problem everywhere? If you go to a coffee shop, is the same thing?
I only have used my Wi-Fi at home. I'm just using 4G.
I would try just to see. I would go somewhere else, maybe use a friend's Wi-Fi or just somewhere else, just to see if the same thing happens, because that will narrow it down. It is sometimes the case that your router and a device don't play nice together. I've seen that happen.
It worked fine for a year or so, and it made me update my firmware on my Wi-Fi, and I also did a factory reboot on my phone.
How about other devices? Is your Wi-Fi act normally on a laptop or?
Yeah, also my iPads and laptops. They don't seem to be a problem.
Okay. Yeah.
It's also have a hard time reaching my Sonos.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to be definitive when you're talking about radio frequency, and this is the problem with Wi-Fi. In fact, we just had a great conversation yesterday on our Screensavers show with Jim Salter, who's a Wi-Fi guru, an engineering expert, who's written a number of articles on why Wi-Fi is so bad. He's testing Wi-Fi routers right now for the Wirecutter, and it is a black art, frankly. I mean, and it may be that the OnePlus 3's Wi-Fi is deteriorating, you know, maybe. But usually something like that will either work or not work. You know, it's hard. We were just I was just reviewing the OnePlus 5. I don't have a copy, but it's the new OnePlus phone. Yep. And somebody on I think it was on Reddit said, all I have to do to take this phone off of my 5G Wi-Fi network is touch it.
Wow.
And this is the problem with radio frequency. Yeah, clearly touching it detunes the antenna in the phone, and it for some reason really affects the 5G. I don't know if 2.4 is affected. Apparently not. But he shows a video. There's a video of him looking at, you know, his connection, his 5 gigahertz connection to his Wi-Fi, and he touches the phone, and boom, it completely attenuates. It's like the iPhone. Remember the iPhone 4, where if you held it in a certain way, you'd break it? So this is
the antenna outside.
Yeah, and this is just kind of the nature of these things. I can't tell you what's wrong. But it's certainly possible it's the phone. It's also possible it's a interaction, that it's an unusual interaction between the phone and the Wi-Fi router. And that's why I think one thing that would be worth doing is trying that phone on somebody else's Wi-Fi just to see if the same thing happens. It also can be settings in the phone, and that's something you might want to investigate as well. Out of time, though. Nice to talk to you. Thanks for listening in Denmark. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, hey, hey. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, smartphones, smart watches. We'll be talking digital photography with Chris Marquardt in about half an hour, our camera guy. He'll be joining us live. He says he wants to grade my photos. Oh, no. oh, no. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number if you have a question, a comment, a suggestion. And I mentioned it a couple of times, but I'll mention it again. There's a website just for this show. It's free. There's no sign up. I don't have a newsletter. I don't want your email address. I don't make you pay for access. It's wide open, and it's there for you. It's there as a resource, techguylabs.com. And every page is a show. Within every show, we break it down into hours and then questions. So you can go right to the question you want. You can read our text summary, but you can also listen or watch because we put video of it after the fact. TechGuyLabs.com. TechGuyLabs.com. Let's go to Stacy in Los Angeles, our next call. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, Leo. May I just tell you that you make it so much easier for me. I am kind of tech phobic, and I find it really helpful to listen to you. Thank you for that.
And it is important. Okay. I know, even if you hate tech.
No, I don't hate it. I'm just afraid of it.
Yeah. Well, it's like math, too. You know, even if you're not comfortable with it, we kind of need to know it now, don't we?
Please don't make me solve an algebra problem.
I won't. I promise. No, I promise. But it's like that, right? It's just something that gets in your head, and then you just, I don't like it. And yet, you know, we're surrounded by technology now. We got to use it.
Exactly. All right. So I'm calling because I would like a dash cam. Unfortunately, someone ran a red light and totaled my car. There are no cameras at that intersection. And, you know, it's her word against mine. And then also my brother is an Uber driver. And with all the news lately about problems with passengers and drivers.
Yeah, if I were a driver of any kind, I would absolutely have a dash cam to protect yourself as much as anything else.
Exactly. Yeah. So my first question is, do I know that the dash cams face the street, but are there some that also record what's going on in
the
interior of the car?
You bet. And of course, cabbies and Uber drivers are the ones who buy those, a lot of them. So the company that – so it's an interesting – this is a huge category, and there are a million of these, as you probably have noted, as you wandered around on Amazon and on the net. That
I did, and that's why I called
them. A ton of Chinese companies that make them. And I don't have a lot of experience with them. I don't use one, and I haven't had a chance to really try a bunch out. I'll tell you a couple that I'm told often are very handy. Garmin, which was very well known as a GPS manufacturer, desperate to find another business, is starting to make some, I hear, very good dash cams that go forwards. But backwards and forwards, I'm not sure. Let me look and see. But anyway, Garmin would be a name to at least investigate and see what their, their range is. And because they've been around for a long time, we know they're a high-quality company. The chat room is telling me that there's a company called Blackvue, B-L-A-C-K-V-U-E, that does have dash cams that go backwards and forwards. And a number of people, I've heard this name time and time again. It's not a name I'm familiar with otherwise, but a number of people say. Now, the issue, of course, the other issue is going to be installation and which ones are easiest for you to use. The last thing you want is a cord coming from the camera plugging into your cigarette lighter adapter and all of this stuff. So, that's kind of complicated. So look for one that's going to be fairly easy to install without a lot of weird wiring. I think Blackvue's really kind of taken this as their thing. Now, a couple of features you're looking for that both Garmin and Blackvue include is GPS, so that the video is tied to the exact location.
Oh, perfect.
Blackvue doesn't require a lot of lighting because wiring because it ties to your phone. So the image and everything, the recording, the backup, everything goes to the phone.
Oh, great.
Which is kind of an interesting idea, you know? You don't have, and power, well, that'll be another issue. A lot of cars, though, have power in the headliner up there. So, and it would be a great thing if you're really serious about it to get somebody to install this who knows what they're doing. I'm going to open this up to the chat room and the people listening. What do you use for a dash cam? Not a backup cam. But one that looks at what's going on outside, and ideally one that goes looks at what's going on inside the car for drivers. I think that's very, very handy. I should know more about this. You're not the first person to ask about it. I haven't gotten around to trying it all. But the chat room does say that a number of people in the chat room use Blackvue's and say they're very good quality.
Oh, terrific. I will continue to listen, and if it's somebody else...
Somebody will help, I'm sure. Else. Yeah.
Okay, thank you
Hey,
so
nice
much.
To talk to you. Thanks for calling. I appreciate it. Yeah, I do my best to keep up with the wide range of technology. It's gone crazy, hasn't it? What happened when I first started doing these shows, I first started doing technology call-in radio shows in 1991. that was a long time ago, wasn't it? And in 91, I remember we were still using Windows 3.0. Most people were still using DOS. I think it was DOS 3.3 or DOS 5, MS-DOS. There was really no internet to speak of. Only universities and researchers knew anything about this thing called the internet. There weren't portable computers like smartphones. That was a pipe dream. That was a fantasy. And now, because computing has gotten so inexpensive and the chips have gotten so small, and really thanks a lot to the iPhone, to the evolution of portable computing, and the ramping up of manufacture and innovation around things like the iPhone, we're seeing what we talked about 20, 30 years ago as, in the future, is now here. It's called ubiquitous computing. You have... Instead of a single, very smart device sitting on your desk, you have little computers everywhere. And that's what these dash cams really are. They're computers and cameras. And they have Wi-Fi. And a lot of the technology that you see in these dash cams comes from smartphones. Same thing with drones. I don't think anybody predicted the quadcopter revolution, certainly not in 1991. And they wouldn't exist if in 2007 Apple hadn't created the iPhone and driven a market for tiny, inexpensive, and when I say tiny, I mean molecular-sized accelerometers, cameras, and the smarts to drive these quadcopters, not to mention that in many cases, these quadcopters' remotes are, in fact, your smartphone. So it's been a fascinating thing to watch. Everybody, you know, wasn't much of a insightful prediction to say. In fact, Gordon Moore did it more than 40 years ago, that just to say we're going to see a massive exponential increase in computing power. He predicted the computing power would double every 18 months. He did that 40 years ago, and he was right. It has. But maybe what we didn't see was that it would get smaller, that it would get more efficient, that it would get more powerful, and that the price would come down to almost nothing, to incredibly low price. And some of that's driven by manufacturing processes that were prompted by the sale of hundreds of millions of iPhones. So if I knock Apple and the iPhone, I should also really thank them, because that has jump-started an amazing thing. And, of course, now we're hearing about the Internet of Things, right? Every device in your house will someday be connected to the Internet. Not just your cameras and your TV set, but your refrigerator and your microwave oven. I have a toaster oven that's Internet connected. That's crazy. Buzz in Huntington Beach, California. You're next. Hi, Buzz.
Hey, how you doing?
I got to warn you. I got about 15 seconds, so I picked you up, but I'm going to get to you in a second, okay? But we do have to take a break, okay? You have issues with your mail, right? And I know what's going on.
20 years automatically logging in. All of a sudden, it's two-factor authentication. I go to...
I know what's going on, and I can fix it, but I'll have to do it right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Let's say hi to Buzz in Huntington Beach. Apple has thrown a monkey wrench, I think, into a lot of people's systems by requiring two-factor, which is a good thing, but it can screw up things. What do you use to get your email?
I'm using Mac Mail. I've been one of those stupid people that a long time ago I used to pay $100 a year for it, and you know, it's worked seamlessly. I've never had to re-input my password. It just automatically has been logging in for 20 years. Well, the two-factor, I've gone to their website, and, well, I figured, okay, if I forgot the password, let me go to my keychain and see if I can sneaky get in there and turn the password button on, which I did. And it accepted my password that I've been using to change apps and so on and so forth, and it showed the password that I thought it was. I put the password in, and it won't let me into Mac Mail.
Yeah, I mean, that's puzzling. A lot of third-party applications which don't understand two-factor authentication may require, and this is a problem you'll see with other companies as well, something called a temporary application password or an app-specific password, and you can generate those.
Right, this is direct, Mac Mail.
Because it's Apple's own mail program, it should absolutely understand two-factor.
It's not accepting the password that's been accepting for 20 years.
Yeah. Let me ask the chat room if anybody's had that issue. I have two-factor turned on, but I don't use Apple's mail program. So what I do is I have to go through some hoops. Are you getting iCloud mail? Who's your mail provider?
The mail provider is Mac Mail or .me or
it's iCloud.
It's iCloud.
Yeah.
iCloud or Mobile Me won't accept the password. But I did get a chance to go to Apple ID and do all the changes, and it accepted my password, and I've changed it and everything, and I changed my. They made me change my password.
What's supposed to happen? The way it's set up, and I'm not crazy about this, but this is the way it sets up: is that you enter the password, and then Apple will send kind of flag you on your other Mac devices, your other Apple devices. I think Apple's really having problems, frankly, with their two-step authentication. And I'm not sure exactly what's going on. I would suggest a call to Apple. This is the kind of thing that they will know exactly what's going on. And they will also know if for some reason your password was changed. So this is not one I can help you with. I haven't had this problem, and it doesn't look like anybody in the chat room has. So it sounds like something that you're going to need to call Apple and have a conversation with them. I have mixed feelings. On the one hand, two-factor is a must. And everywhere I can use two-factor, and that includes Google, of course, my Gmail account, my Twitter account, my Facebook account, my bank account. Wherever I can, I use two-factor. And for those who are saying, well, what are you talking about? Well, of course, for years, the way we've logged into these accounts is with a username and a password. But to make this more robust, in case somebody guesses your password, steals your password, looks over your shoulder and sees your password, to make this robust, many systems add a second authentication factor. Usually, you only have to use it the first time. Then they save a cookie or some little file on your machine that says, yeah, we've seen this machine before. But it's very effective in stopping hackers because if it's well designed, the second factor is difficult for a hacker to guess. And generally, the factors that you can use, this is all about authentication, which is a hard thing to do. I saw the other day that some notary publics are starting to use webcams to notarize documents. And that's, of course, completely crazy. The reason you have a notary it's almost a kind of two-factor, isn't it, right? To really prove that you are who you say you are, you go to a human being in person. They look at your ID. They look at you. They make sure nobody's holding you at gunpoint. They may, in California at least, I imagine it's true elsewhere, they get your fingerprint. Authentication is a big problem. It's a very difficult thing to do. And so what we have, there's three ways you can authenticate. We call these the three factors of authentication. One is something you know, something that's in your mind, like a password or a secret question, that kind of thing. Another thing would be something you have, and that could be your smartphone, could be a little dongle. That's how these used to work, still do in some cases. You have a little thing on your keychain that every 30 seconds has a six-digit number on it. That would be something you have. Or something you are, that would be like a fingerprint, a biometric, or eye print, iris scan, that kind of thing. Something you know, something you have, something you are. Two-factor would combine two of those. It wouldn't be two things you know, because that'd be dopey. That wouldn't help you. To beat the hackers, what you want to do is something you know and something you have. And that's how Apple's doing it. You enter in your password, and then it says, okay, we've not seen this machine before. You've not logged in on this machine before. So we're going to send you a code. And the way Apple generally does it is they send you a code on all your other Apple devices, which is a little strange. Your bank might do it by sending you a text message. That, by the way, is not a super secure way to do it because phone numbers are easily stolen and spoofed. But a text message, probably the best way to do it, and I don't know why Apple doesn't support this, is with an authenticator program. This is how Google does it, how Facebook does it. You have a program that generates time-based six-digit codes. Every 30 seconds, they refresh. They're only good for 30 seconds. That code is based on a secret number that is yours and yours alone and the time of day. If you have Google Authenticator or Microsoft Authenticator or Authy, there are a lot of authenticator programs in your phone. You've used this before when you log into Google. It says, all right, well, what's your six-digit code? I guess this must be hard for people because everybody, Apple and Google and others, they're going to other methods, which may or may not be more secure. I think the authenticator method's great. Somebody would have to have your phone and have it set up. You know, if they steal your phone and they've got your password, well, I guess then they can log in. But that's why we have passwords on our phones, right? Make it even harder. So Apple is doing something that is not like anybody else I've seen. And it kind of encouraged, maybe it's because then you have to have more than one Apple device. I don't know. What do they do if this is your first Apple device? I don't know. Do they phone you? Do they text you? I don't know. Remember in the old days, Boz is reminding me, in the old-fashioned days, you would get a PIN mailed to you, right? By the U.S. Postal Service. The notary is really a two-factor, form of two-factor. So Apple's system, they send a text. Jack says they'd send a text. Okay. Texting is, as we know, not the most secure, but it's better than nothing. So I think the best thing, if you're having trouble with two-factor, and Apple has forced everybody into two-factor, call Apple at this point. AppleCare, the people at AppleCare are very good. They, I'm sure, are dealing with a number of two-factor issues. They can look at your password, see if it's been changed recently. They can help you get it done. Chris Marquardt is going to grade my photos. when we come back, we'll talk to the photo guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Chris Marquardt is here. He's our digital photographer, my personal digital photography guru. I do want to thank you because, you know, every time I go on a trip, I take too many pictures. Lisa took 4,000 on this trip. I took 4,000. We came back with 8,000 images from a two-week trip. And often is the case that I'm just overwhelmed. I never get through them, and they're just a pile of pictures stored on my hard drive.
That can happen, definitely, but especially on a trip like this.
I read and took to heart your PDF, 1,000 photos in an hour, and I used your method, which you should get the PDF from Chris, and you could do it just by signing up.
It's free. It's free. Yeah. 1hour1000pics.com.
Yeah, 1hour1000pics.com. But in summary, the method, and we use Lightroom, but you could use something else. In fact, Lightroom is so slow with my 30-megapixel camera that I bought something called Photo Mechanic that is just for reviewing pictures, and then you can put them into Lightroom because it's fast. And so the trick is to go through all your photos in kind of a and I did this every night, Chris, in a very kind of relaxed fashion. Just say that's good, and then you know which takes out about half of them or out of focus or screwed up or whatever. And you're without being too judgmental doing the pics. Then you have a very sneaky trick in Lightroom, which is the refine command, which basically unflags everything you flagged, but then rejects everything you didn't flag. So now you have a pile of unrejected photos and a pile of rejected photos. You don't have to delete the rejected photos, but you also don't
have to... That's kind of the trick. That's a psychological trick.
You don't have to look at them either. Then you go through, and this is the second stage, you go through and you score all the photos. And I like your system, 1, 2, or 3 stars. 1 star is... Yeah, that's a keeper for personal purposes. 2 stars, I could possibly save that one if I crop it and edit it just so, but it's going to take some work. 3 stars is that's almost done. That's like a great image. I don't have to do too much. And then, and this is really sneaky, you only look at the 3-star images after that.
And then if you have time, you can go to the 2-star pictures. But yeah. Usually you end up with the 3 stars, and that's kind of where it stops. But you have kind of the best selection of your 4,000 photos.
It worked great. And so by doing this, at the end of every day, I'd have about 5 or 6 pictures. That's all.
That's awesome, yeah.
But I was very happy with those, and I ended up putting those into my Sway.
So I did look at the pictures.
Yes.
And well, first of all, they're all awesome photos.
Thank you. Okay. Get that out of the way. Okay.
They must be for you because they all have a meaning for you.
Yeah,
you
know, they're meaningful.
You wear them, you have the memories. Yeah, they have meaning for you, and that's kind of important.
I wasn't trying to make this a gallery showing. I was trying to make it something that we would, as a family, look at.
And then they will certainly ring with people who have already been there because they kind of that will trigger memories,
right.
Or they might ring with people who want to go there because they kind of anticipate that. So there is something in those photos that people can connect to, but then there are a few photos in there that kind of click with more people.
Yeah,
that will get more people engaged. And I've looked at them, and 3 of them kind of jumped out at me. And the first one is that figurine around Machu Picchu in some museum that's holding something that looks like a smartphone.
Yeah, that kind of cracked me up. All of the statues, all the pre-Columbian statues are holding smartphones.
That's what it looks like. That's exactly the photo I'm talking about. And this one, I think, clicks with more people because of exactly that. They can relate to that. It's something that they have in their experience. Also, the light on this is just awesome. This very interesting light, kind of a side lighting that brings out the textures really nicely. So that together with what's going on in the photo, people can relate to that, and that makes it interesting. So that is one. The other one that I found really beautiful is that photo of that big rock, that split rock with a little boat. Yeah.
That's completely unretouched. That's, they call it kicker rock.
That, I believe you, that's the way it came out of the camera. Yeah. And the way the sun, again, interesting light, the sun is coming from the side. It brings out the texture, it brings out the relief of that thing. Then the rock being split, you have this ship in there that kind of gives it scale. So all of a sudden you get the sense of how big that thing is. The evening sun just brings out the warm rock, so that is, yeah, that's
thank
definitely
you. Yeah, I loved that one
of the good ones. Yeah. But last but not least, the one that I think you put that on the top of your sway, is the sea lion. Is that a sea lion?
It is a sea lion. Good for you, because everybody else says it's a seal. But though these are, believe it or not, they're California sea lions.
Awesome.
Yeah.
They came what are down. They came,
well, that's what's weird about the Galapagos is there's four big currents that bring stuff from the Antarctic. So there's penguins, stuff from the tropics. So there's flamingos. And stuff from the north, like this sea lion, that is basically the same sea lion you'll see on the piers in San Francisco.
So you told me before that a lot of people love that picture and it clicks with them.
The sea lion is yelling at a bird, a flightless cormorant.
I think I can try to help you understand what is going on, why it clicks with people. So there are a few things about this photo that make it work from my point of view. And that one is it has two very clear subjects. It's really clear what's going on in the picture. There's no ambiguity. There's nothing weird sticking out in the background. Then the way the light in the photo guides your attention is very, very good because it's evening light again.
Sunset.
That kind of helps photos come out, and you can see this from the angle of the light and also from the warmth of the light. And then there is good contrast between what's going on in the foreground and in the background. So the subjects kind of, they are clear. It's very clear what they are. There are two subjects that communicate with each other, that do something with each other, and that kind of clicks with us a bit. And then, again, no distractions. If you look at the foreground, that rock is not in the light. It's dark, it's subdued, it doesn't distract from the subjects. There's not much going on in the background. So it's a very, very simplified setting, and simplification in photos will almost always make them stronger. And then what's most important is we can relate to what's going on. I mean, yeah. I don't know, maybe I had a boss this. Like this. You
I
know?
Can sell this as a stock photo because it's clearly, you know, he's yelling at the bird and the bird's going, what are you talking about?
Again, maybe you once had a boss like this who was shouting at you, or maybe you've been in the army. I can only imagine that's
the
what
drill
it might
sergeant
be like.
Sea lion, yeah.
It's kind of a drill sergeant thing. But there's a story, you know?
Yeah.
And that story might be different for everyone. But it's, of course, it's sea lion shouting at a bird. But what is it? Why is it doing that? What's the bird thinking? The bird, the way the bird looks back, it's almost like shrugging it off and saying, keep shouting. I won't.
The sea lion wanted the bird to leave. The bird wouldn't leave, so he just lay down next to him.
And we totally anthropomorphize this.
We
find what is in us and how that clicks. And what we do is I usually call it your backpack. Over our life, we put stuff in our backpack. We know situations. We know people like that. And whenever we look at a photo, we will kind of filter it through that. We will pick things out of our backpack and kind of match them with what's going on there. And that is just, I mean,
it's and can I just say that. Completely lucky shot. I mean, I had none of that stuff.
Don't tell anyone. That was Leo, your line should be this was totally on purpose. I wanted it that way.
But that is a good argument for knowing your camera and being able to use it swiftly, because what happened is the guide says, "Oh, look, that sea lion's trying to kick the bird off," and I swung this giant, and having the right camera at the right time does make a big difference. I have to say.
Oh, and you were there, you were prepared, you had everything ready. So, yeah.
Thank you, Chris.
Totally everything came together.
Find out more about Chris and his workshops. He's making me feel good. DiscoverTheTopFloor.com. And of course, this segment brought to you by the Epson Fast Photo Scanner, the world's fastest photo scanner. Fast and easy. Scan thousands of photos as fast as 1 per second at 300 DPI. Restore, save, organize, and share your collection. Thanks, Chris.
Sure.
Big Sports Fan 99 says, anyone know if Apple's killing off the iPad Mini? They haven't talked much about the iPad Mini in the last couple of events that Apple's had. And they haven't updated it since last year this time. I hope not. I think that's a great form factor. But the truth is nobody knows. The only people who know whether Apple's killing off anything or adding anything or doing anything are the people inside the Apple building. And they're not talking. In fact, we heard a very interesting leaked audio tape of an Apple staff meeting about not leaking this week. It was kind of a funny leak. Somebody leaked the meeting telling people not to leak. But they show some movies. They explain why it's not in Apple's interest, how disappointing it is for the teams when people already know what Apple's going to announce. And I think I understand that from the point of view of Apple's business, not letting, you know, having people not know what's coming is, you know, it's better from their business point of view. For one thing, if you say, we're going to replace the Mini with a better Mini, nobody's going to buy the Mini until you do that. Something called the Osborne effect, because it was famously demonstrated about 30 years ago by a guy named Adam Osborne, who announced that there would be an Osborne 2 computer at the height of the sales of the Osborne 1 computer, killing the sales of the Osborne 1. The Osborne 2 was far off, at least 6 months off. The company went out of business, went bankrupt. So they call it the Osborne effect. You don't pre-announce products because it kills sales of the other products. Now, I have to point out that as a journalist and as users, we want to know. You know, if there's going to be a better version of the iPad out in a couple of weeks, I want to know that. So it's my job and the job of the tech journalist community in general to figure out what Apple's going to do, to find out, to use leaks and any other means possible to get that information. And I think Apple knows that. We're trying all the time to get, you know, pierce that curtain of silence. They're very good at secrecy. But most of the time, if you see a rumor, an Apple rumor, you have to take it with a grain of salt, because nobody from Apple will say. And all I could do is guess. I guessed wrong. I really thought that the MacBook Air was going to be killed. It may still be killed at this point. It doesn't really fit in with the rest of the line. They've got the MacBook. They've got the MacBook Pro. Where's the Air fit in there? But a lot of people still like it. The Mini may be kind of the same. I don't know. One thing we don't really know is how well a Mini sells. Because Apple doesn't break down its sales figures. It just says iPad in general. Be my guess, the Mini doesn't sell very well. If there's an iPad that really doesn't sell well, it would be the Mini. In fact, some have guessed that the poor sales of the Mini are what dragged down iPad sales in general. And the reason I would guess it doesn't sell well is because it's so close in size to the largest iPhone that people probably just buy the iPhone and forego the Mini. I like the Mini. I have a Mini. I bought the Mini last year, the new one, and it's a nice size for, you know, when you're lying in bed and stuff. Having a little bit of a smaller one's a good size for travel. Don't know. And no one does know until Apple does it. Our show today brought to you by a Carbonite online backup. Goodness gracious me. Good golly, Miss Molly. If you're not backing up, you know you're going to lose data. You will lose data. Hard drives fail. Disasters happen. Acts of God, fire, flood, tornado. And, of course, there's always human error. And that may be the most disastrous disaster of all. Oops, I fat-fingered that file. It's gone forever. Or worse, you've got a perfect spreadsheet. You're ready to send it off to the boss, and you think, I just want to change this one thing, and you mess the whole thing up. Now, with Carbonite, you don't have to worry, because there's good copies of everything you do on the Carbonite cloud, away from the premises. That means it's safe even from acts of God. Thunder and lightning and fire and tornado and giant sinkholes can't do it because you've got everything up there in the Carbonite cloud. I want you to try Carbonite. You can try it free for your home or for your office. By the way, the worst act of God here, ransomware. You're safe from that too. Go to Carbonite.com. Pick the plan you like. Try it free. One thing I'd ask, though, use my name Leo as the offer code. That way you'll get 2 months free with purchase. Yeah, 2 months free. You got to back it up to get it back. Do it right. Carbonite.com. Wendy, Los Angeles, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I am great. How are you?
Well, I'm driving, so I'm going to pull right the heck over. But there was a lady who called a while ago who said she was tech adverse.
Yeah.
That would be me.
Yeah, sure.
I work on a PC. I have an iMac at home. I mean, an iPad at home. Sorry, I'm nervous. And I know how to do all of that stuff, but I don't know the ins and outs.
Yeah.
So here's
By the way, you're in the vast majority.
I am?
Oh, yeah.
Thank goodness.
Probably does feel sometimes like, oh, everybody gets this but me. But no one gets it.
Oh, bless you. The other thing I wanted to say was I listen to you all the time, so I have sort of a vague idea of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's pretty much everybody has a vague idea. That's pretty much everybody except the engineers that design this stuff, and they're the only ones who really understand how it works. And it's locked away in their brains.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, it's when you reach a certain age, people assume that you are just stupid. Not that I'm stupid.
I know. That's shameful, and I know, but I know that. Yeah, and that
okay,
so you young whippersnappers, you don't know nothing. You don't know. Actually, let me say this one thing, Wendy. It is true that there's a whole generation growing up that knows how to use these but has no idea how they work. And, you know, because they've grown up with them. And so they kind of, they've internalized things like, well, you Google for that and you read this page. But if something broke or they had to diagnose something or they had to troubleshoot it, they wouldn't know where to start. And they don't care.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, any more than you would know what to do if your toaster or your microwave broke. It's just a thing for them.
You've met me. But they certainly cannot write in cursive, but we won't go with that.
Good news. You'll never have to write in cursive again.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, though, that they've released surveys that if you take notes in cursive, it sticks in your brain.
Interesting.
I'm a trial attorney, and I take notes in handwriting because I remember everything now.
Interesting. Do younger attorneys in court sit there with laptops? How do they take notes? They have to write, right?
Yes. Many of them now are taking it. It's computerized.
Interesting. And the judge doesn't say, stop that clickety-clack, you're annoying me?
No, because the judge is on their own.
They're all on their iPhones playing Candy Crush Saga.
But the interesting thing is I'm actually on a jury of all things, and there's a good old-fashioned notebook and pen.
Yep.
And that's what they give us.
I know. When I served on a jury, boy, the judge would take your phone if it went off, if it rang. He says, give me that.
You betcha.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's my question. My 18-year-old actually graduated high school without me killing her. So now she's going to college.
Quite an accomplishment. Yes.
Right. You have no idea. So
yes, I do.
She has the iPhone that I made her work to buy when she was 13. So
good
that was
for
5 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
She hasn't updated it. I mean, she'd like to get a new one, but hasn't because I won't pay.
Right.
But I did tell her that if she got through algebra, by God, I would get her a Mac, whatever you call it. I want to say a desktop, but that's the wrong thing.
No. So, a laptop, probably.
Right.
So she's going to college next year.
God willing.
Or this fall.
So,
and do you know what she'll be studying?
General ed for the first year.
Yeah, right, of course. Nobody knows what they want to do.
She's not a graphics person or a computer person, any of those things.
Okay.
So I had gone to the Apple store, and I talked to somebody, and I said, I want to get the and he said, no, you want to get the blah, blah.
That's because the whole Apple marketing plan now is to sell you these iPads as computers. In fact, you've even seen ads, probably, that say everything your laptop could do, the iPad could do. Lies.
Right. I was fine until I heard you today, because I put on the radio and you said, blah, 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 iPad, the new ones are going to do this.
Apple's,
and the other
this is Apple's goal, is to make them more and more like a computer. Apple's not said this, but I am firmly of the belief that Apple doesn't want to make Macintosh computers very much. They do make a few of them, but they really see their future in mobile touch devices. But that's not where we are today. And I think I think your daughter would probably, here's what I would look at for her, a MacBook.
Thank you.
The MacBook is the thinnest, lightest Macintosh. It's not the most powerful, but she doesn't need the most powerful.
Why not?
Well, she's not, because she's not designing rocket engines and she's not playing video games. Those are the only two things that take a lot of power. So I think for a student, portability, convenience, a MacBook is a really good choice. And that's probably what I'd go with. But hold on. We'll talk some more off the air. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Paul on the line, Lake Forest, California. Hi, Paul. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo.
Hello, Paul.
I'm in the decision-making stage of kicking cable to the curb.
I am, too. I'm right at the right at the point of doing it.
Yeah, so I'm thinking of Sling TV plus an antenna.
Yeah, that's so you might not even need the antenna because Sling TV in some markets offers locals.
So. Yeah, but not enough for me.
Okay. So you've already looked. Yep.
Yeah. And
So Sling TV is what, about $40 a month?
Well, it depends upon how many extras you pile on.
You can get Showtime with it, too, and so forth.
Yeah. I actually already get Showtime through the over-the-top or whatever they call
it. Well, see, yeah. I think over-the-top is the term. You're right, and it's a weird term. But what it means is you're getting it directly from Showtime or HBO instead of through a cable company. That means you pay them.
Right.
You'll find very quickly when you add it all up, including internet access, that it ends up being a very similar cost. You don't save money cord cutting as much as you do stick it to the man.
Yeah, well,
and the man deserves it these days. Cable companies are the worst.
I think in the basic cable service, I still would wind up saving a bit of money because I'm pretty sure, you know, I'm paying close to $200 a month.
Oh, yeah.
Cable and internet.
Oh, yeah. You'll cut that in half. And because you have an antenna and you get over the air, you're going to, truthfully, over the air is the best quality. If you've got, you know, a good signal, it's the best quality HD you can get.
Yeah. The only thing is I would want a DVR for the over the air.
That's right. And there are two companies that do that. TiVo does.
Yeah.
And Channel Master. And actually, there's a third company. Silicon Dust makes something called the HD Home Run. And all of those will let you take over-the-air signals and record them, DVR them.
Okay. Yeah, I've had TiVo before. I just was kind of, you know, I've heard...
TiVo's the best, in my opinion, but... a lot of people like Channel Master. The advantage of Channel Master is you don't pay a monthly fee for the TV guide, which it really annoys me that TiVo charges you for that.
You know, I think with the Romeo now, you get it. I mean, you pay like $400 up front, but you get it.
I ended up buying Lifetime, but that concerns me too because, as you probably know, TiVo was sold to a company called Rovi, who has already said, well, we don't really care about hardware that much. So now I'm worried. I don't, you know, I have a Lifetime subscription to TiVo on three different TiVos, but that's only, you know, Lifetime's not my Lifetime, that's for sure. It's probably the lifetime of the device, but who knows? You know, maybe it's the lifetime of TiVo. Maybe it's the lifetime of Rovi's interest in supporting it. I don't know what lifetime means. And it's expensive. When you add the hardware of the TiVo, which is $300 or $400, to the lifetime subscription, you double the price. That's a very expensive device.
Well, I think the Romeo right now, which I don't think is their latest and greatest, is $400 with the lifetime.
Oh, that's a good deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you what the reason I got an expensive one is because I wanted 4K. And you may think about that because you may at some point get a 4K TV, and then you're going to say, oh, I wish I had a...
Well, I have a 4K TV right now, but, you know, over the air isn't 4K, so
right.
Who cares?
No, it's, so one of the things about cord cutting is now you're going to start looking at both internet and maybe perhaps Blu-ray and other forms of entertainment, and you get an inexpensive UHD Blu-ray player, you're going to be seeing stuff that looks so gorgeous on a 4K TV that beats anything you can get over the air. And increasingly, Netflix, Vudu, and others are starting to push 4K content that looks pretty darn good. It doesn't look as good as the UHD Blu-ray, but it looks good. Since you've got the TV...
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you're right though. With the TiVo, you're not recording 4K. So I get I guess what you're saying is I'll never use it for 4K content. And you're right.
Right. I've already got all those services on my TV itself.
Actually, somebody's telling me that now through the end of the month, Romeo's down to $300.
Oh.
Yeah, they're having a sale. See, that worries me.
Yeah, I know. So,
that really worries me. That means almost certainly they're discontinuing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Mike B. in the chat room, who is a TV expert on all of this stuff, he says you should also look at Plex. You'll be using your own hardware but you can get a lifetime cable guide on Plex for, you know, very little money.
Oh, because I already have a Plex server.
Oh, you know, you're already doing all this stuff. You kind of know doing here.
I was just looking for the hardware recommendation. I mean, the main reason I'm going away from cable is because I watch so little cable.
So you want you want a DVR that'll do over the air? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah. I look at the Channel Master.
Okay.
A lot of people liked Channel Master. I think the TiVo UI is the best out there. But I don't. Like I said, I think its future is cloudy. to quote the Magic 8 Ball. So Channel Master and perhaps the HD Home Run, depending on the capabilities you want.
Yeah. Although, like I said, I had a TiVo about 10 years ago, and its future was cloudy back then.
I know. I don't know how they survived. Remember, they had a competitor called Replay that was sued out of existence. Or was it Replay TV? Yeah, I think so.
Something like that, yeah.
It was sued out of existence because they had the temerity to offer a 30-second skip, which let you skip ads. And at the time, everybody was very sensitive about that. TiVo has since added that feature to some programming.
Yeah, well, they've always had it, so but it was a hack.
Yeah, there was a hidden control. I remember that. I wrote about that in my first TiVo book way back when. So, yeah, so DVR, I guess you could create your own DVR. In fact, I know you could, using PC, and you'd have to get some hardware to get the signal in, you know, to connect to the antenna, and you'd have to, and so forth and so on. But
I mean, I've got a couple of spare PCs sitting in the closet, so.
Yeah, well, that's another, you know, there's Myth TV. There's a whole bunch of ways to do that. Plex is actually probably the best out there right now.
Okay.
So, yeah, that would be the other thing to look into is using Plex and an old PC to make your own DVR, you make your own OTR DVR, OTA DVR. That would be, I think, if you have the interest and the skills and the hardware to do that, that's going to be the long-term most satisfying. And certainly, Plex will be around forever. I don't think Plex is in any danger. And because you're doing it yourself, you should be in good shape.
Okay, well, I didn't know Plex even offered that sort of possibility, so that's news to me.
I believe so, yeah. I believe so. So look into it anyway. That's what the chat room's saying.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I'm just saying I hadn't heard that, so.
Yeah, and Mike B. says, now, Mike, are you using this for over-the-air recording? He's using a Synology, but I think you could, you know, do the same thing with your old PCs in the closet. You might want to upgrade them a little bit with a hard drive and so forth. But
yeah,
I think this probably is a very good solution for OTA DVR. And plus, you get a lot more. So we'll put a link in the show notes to Plex's site, plex.tv. They have a live TV DVR. And Mike's just put the link in there in the show notes. It's one of the features. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. I think we should all cut the cord. Send the message to the cable companies that their predatory practices, you know, are just not acceptable. They've been raising the costs of cable TV well beyond, you know, their costs or the cost of living. It's amazing how much cable television's gone up. $200 a guy's spending. We ought to stand up and be counted here. 8888 Ask Leo. More to come. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Want to ask about tech, talk about tech, share your experiences. Still looking for a good dash cam that can go forward and backward. If you've got any suggestions there. Naomi on the line from Denver. Hi, Naomi.
Hello, Leo.
Hi. Welcome.
Yeah, you wanted me to report back on my Pixel.
Oh, so refresh my memory. You were in the market for a smartphone?
Well, it was my very first smartphone.
Oh, wow.
And it was the one I picked because of the security.
Yay.
And it was the good news first.
Okay.
We were out in Nowhereville, Kansas, and I ran Waze and Google Maps. I was playing tunes.
Isn't that nice?
Reading and writing email. I had the weather on there because there was some changing weather, and I was doing Google inquiries. Plus, I was taking pictures, and I thought, oh, man, I'll overload it, and it'll start blowing up or whatever. Never did. Boy, it took it and took it.
Good. How did you like the pictures you got? Were you happy with those?
Oh, wow. Are those fantastic or what?
It's ironic because I was talking about how much camera equipment I brought on my vacation, but I ended up taking the best picture of the vacation with my Pixel. It's a little frustrating. It really is a good camera. They built a very nice camera in there. Okay, so what's the bad?
However, and you knew there would be one.
You warned me.
Yeah, I couldn't make or take phone calls unless I would clear the cache, turn it off, turn it on, and then it was intermittent. Maybe two or three times you had to turn it off.
Now, is this everywhere or just in this remote location?
everywhere.
Oh no, that's not
right. Denver, right.
And whose cell service are you using?
Verizon. I was going to try to go with Fi, but Verizon had me hooked in. What?
They do. If there's an industry that's as nearly as predacious as the cable industry, it would be the cell phone industry.
Well, I agree.
You put the two together, and I think most of the problems in this country come from those two companies.
Who needs them?
Exactly.
Right here.
So there's something wrong with your Pixel. That's not. I make phone calls all the time. Obviously.
Oh, anyway, yeah. I would get these things with, your phone is not responding. Please do this. You know, give feedback. So I would give these flaming feedbacks, like 15 and 20 at a time.
Oh, you know, no, there's no one at Google actually reading those, you know.
Oh, it's probably Verizon. Well,
maybe.
Then we go on. And so then I thought.
Did you get it at a Verizon store?
I took it to a Verizon store.
No, but where'd you buy it?
They didn't even have the key to open it. They didn't even realize you had to change the SIM card. You know, it's like this guy had been there for maybe 2 days and the manager had been there maybe a week.
Verizon, you know, is notorious for not really supporting anything but a handful of phones, mostly iPhones, that they really want to sell. In fact, Microsoft credits Verizon with the failure of Windows Phone because they said you could never buy one there. They sold them, but good luck finding them. So I would imagine the same thing with the Pixel. I had a Verizon Pixel that I used for actually as I traveled around the world last year, and I found it to work beautifully. So you got a lemon. That's what happened.
Right. So here, let me explain. So then I, you know, did all the flaming feedbacks. Nothing. No response. So then I did chats. Oh, that's exciting. The reason you can't reach them by phone, period.
Oh, no, they don't want to. That's too expensive. Yeah.
Right.
And this, is this Google or Verizon? Are you talking to Google or Verizon at this point?
Well, I don't know. I took the Google thing. It says, help, we're here 24/7.
Yeah, but did you buy it? Where'd you buy it?
I pre-ordered the silver.
From whom? From Google or from Verizon?
From Google. And it can, well, anyway, it's all been. I looked on the web, you know, searched the web, and they have a mic problem, and that was what
no,
it was.
I
couldn't call people, and they couldn't call me. So then I did chats with them, and that's bad because they're using Google Interpreter, which they don't speak English either. So I finally got it turned in. Finally got somebody, and I would not let them go on the chat for over an hour and a half with bad interpretation, losing stuff in translation. Finally got a replacement. Black phone. I ordered a silver phone. So here I am paying $700 and whatever for a phone I didn't order. And I'm supposed to be happy with it. So the last time you bought brown shoes and they sent you black shoes and told you to be happy with them, are you happy with them?
No. You should get what you want. I'm still trying to figure out, from Google or from Verizon?
I went into the Google chat. That's there, you know.
Did you buy it on the web, on the internet?
No.
You bought it in a store?
No. I pre-ordered. I was one of the very first people in the world to have a Pixel. My cute little silver one that I named her Bianca. Yeah, now I have a black one.
I can't help you until I know who you bought it from. Did you buy it from? You have to go to whoever you bought it
okay,
from.
Okay, all right. So then let's say I bought it from Verizon. That's, you know.
Then you go to the Verizon store, and even if they're idiots, they're the ones that replace it. If you bought it from Google, then, and I'm guessing you must have, but I can't figure it out, then you call Google and you say, and by the way, Google has people who will talk to you on the phone. I know I've done it. And you say, you sent me the wrong phone. But this is an excellent phone. I don't know why you're having issues with it. It's probably not the mic problem. You just got a lemon. And I've had two Pixels, and I know many people who have Pixels, and nobody's had this problem. So, but the most important thing I'm trying to say is you go to the place you bought it. If it's Verizon, only Verizon's going to fix it for you. If it's Google, then you need to go to Google. It sounds like you must have gotten it from Google. But I know Google has people who will talk to you. So maybe you bought it from a reseller, in which case that was a mistake. I just don't know. I can't get it out of you, so I don't know what actually happened. But you're right. You should have the phone color you want, and you should have the phone you want, and it should work. And there's no reason why it shouldn't, because of all of those things are doable. I would stay away from Verizon, personally. But on the other hand, and maybe this is related to the problem, if you're using it on Verizon, you should buy it from Verizon. That's why I'm a little puzzled. I'm pretty sure you can't buy the Verizon model from Google. I think you have to buy it from Verizon. So this is why I'm just a little puzzled. Figure out where you got it. And if you got it from a third party, well, I'm sorry. I think that's that, and that I suspect that that's actually what happened. This phone is almost a year old now, so that's another question I have. How long have you had it? 8888 Ask Leo. Sorry, I can't be more help, but I think the answer is clear. Go to the people you bought it from and say, I want the silver one, and I want it to work, period, or I want my money back. But that's true of anything, isn't it? Yeah, I think okay, so Dr. Mom says you can buy it from Google and get it activated on Verizon, but they're not happy to do that. Yeah, that be my. I wouldn't be surprised to hear that. Get it from Verizon if you're going to use it on Verizon. That's for sure. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. On with the show we go with Benny in Pasadena. Hello, Benny.
Hey, Leo. My question is, here, let me get you off the speaker.
Okay, sure. That'd be great.
I basically I'm not trying to think my devices, you know, like my phone, my tablet, my notebook. I do one thing on one and it doesn't appear on the other.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it's supposed to be.
Okay.
but I have to say your expectation is not unusual because now we do so much cloud based computing that a lot of times people say, oh yeah, I make a document here and I should be able to open it and edit it there. But that's only relatively recently. You know, in the past, nothing was connected. Everything had its own storage and that's where your documents were. So you would like to work on something on your laptop and have it be visible on your phone and on your tablet and all of that.
Yeah, for example,
Yeah, a number of ways to do that. What kind of documents are they? Are they writing? Are they notes?
Well, I mean, like for example, like even an email that I look at.
Yeah,
I'll go to another device.
That's a perfect example because that's something that's changed over the last few years. For a long time, when you had an email system, they used a service called a protocol called POP, Post Office Protocol. And the way it worked is you would log in to your email provider, download all the email onto your computer, and then log off, and the email provider would delete all that mail. And so the only copy would exist on your computer. The problem was, as you've noted, as people noticed after a while, as they got more computers, they got more devices, now we all have smartphones, that didn't work so well because you had different copies of the mail in different places. And if you sent something, you'd only see it on the place you sent it from, not the other devices. So a new protocol became more popular. It's not new in the sense that it's younger than Post Office Protocol. It's only a little younger. But it became very popular called IMAP. And it's exactly what you want, which is your mail isn't stored on your local device. Your local device just has a snapshot of the mail that's stored on the server. So who do you get? We'll solve this one at a time. Who do you get your email from?
Gmail.
Okay. So Google has a copy of all your mail. And in fact, if you only use your browser and you go to Gmail, that's the official copy in your browser. Everything, if you haven't deleted it, everything that you've written is there. Everything you received is there. And if you're using Gmail on your laptop, as long as that laptop knows it's Gmail, it'll have the same stuff. Your phone should have the same stuff. You should see the same email everywhere.
Okay.
What are you using? Tell me what kind of hardware you have. What kind of smartphone?
Oh, are you sitting down for this one? It's a Galaxy Samsung S2.
Oh God, no. You know what? That was a great phone. It's what we call these days a classic. I won't call it an antique. It's a classic. Yeah, sure, they're up to the S8, but who cares? You're using an S2. Actually, you know, until recently, President Trump was only using an S3, so, and, you know, he's got plenty of money. So there you go. Nothing wrong with that. So the S2 is probably looking at your Gmail and showing you what is on the server. How about your laptop? What are you looking at? Are you using...
It's a notebook, a Samsung.
Yeah, and so you're using your web browser to look at Gmail, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so your mail should be exactly the same on your phone as is on your laptop. What's happening? You mean mail is that you think is there isn't there, or?
Yeah, like for example, on my S2, when I pull up my email, it's behind. It's not updated. Like,
oh, well, wait a little bit and it'll update. So that just means the S2 isn't getting the email behind your back. But that's not a bad thing. That's probably to save battery life. If it's, you know, if a program is always getting the mail, it's using your battery. So just wait a little bit, or you can check the settings in the mail program and make sure that it updates whenever you open it. And that way it won't be behind. It just hasn't caught up yet. But your mail's still there. Mm. And actually, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the mail, because that's a perfect example of something that's stored on a server, and then each of your devices looks at it. Apple, Microsoft, everybody these days is kind of moving in that direction. For instance, nowadays when you use Microsoft Office, by default, when you save a document, it doesn't save it to your hard drive. It saves it to Microsoft's cloud service, OneDrive. And by doing that, that means that when you open your Microsoft Word on any device, it'll see the same document, because it's not loading it from the device, it's loading it from the cloud. That's why the cloud is so big these days, because it's a centralized place for all your stuff to live. And it solves that problem of having different versions of documents and emails on different places. So Gmail is really, for most people, the first cloud service they ever used. Gmail's 11, 12 years old now. It was certainly the first web app. And it really took off like crazy for that reason, I think. Because finally, I have one email account, and I see the same thing no matter how I look at it, what device I look at it. So I think it's just a question of you paying attention to where you're storing documents. If you make a document on your laptop and you store it on the laptop's hard drive, it's not going to be copied anywhere. It's not going to be available anywhere. But there are plenty of services out there that you can use. Microsoft's OneDrive is one. You probably heard of something called Dropbox. That's probably the most popular of these. If you save a document in your Dropbox folder, then it's automatically copied to every other computer that's running Dropbox, including your S2. So I'm not talking to you. I have to turn off my Amazon Echo. I foolishly set it up so that the trigger word would be computer. How often do you think I say computer on this show? A lot. You're going to have to go mute her. Anyway, that's why we use cloud services. Now, there are people who say, well, I don't. It's so funny because we get calls from both directions. I don't want to store my stuff on Google or on a Microsoft or on Apple. I want to have my stuff private. Well, then you have to create your own cloud or figure out some way else of getting documents on every device. So it's just use cloud services. That's why we like them so much. If you use a Chromebook, for instance, the Google Chromebooks I'm always talking about, they come with very little storage, because most of the time, whatever you're working on is stored on Google Drive. That's Google's version of this. And so it's available. In fact, the beauty of that is if you lose your Chromebook, or if you want to wipe your Chromebook and start over, you don't have to worry about your data, because it's all up in Google Drive, and you just log into your account and you got all your stuff again. So I would suggest looking into the idea of storing your data on the cloud as opposed to storing your data locally. I think that'll solve your problem. Stuart, Beverly Hills, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Yeah, hi, Leo. This is Stuart Miller. How are you?
Hi, I'm very well. How are you?
Good. Very well. Very well. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I'm looking to buy some backup software for my home computer and a home business.
Yep.
And I bought a external SSD hard drive from Samsung, and I'm in order to copy the files. But I'm also looking at some software to be put on the computer. And the things I'm looking on the internet is one is offered by Acronis. There's a Crash Plan.
Yeah.
I'm also looking at Norton Just 2 because I'm using them already to upload my files that way.
I'm really glad that you're thinking about backup, because this is really kind of basic plumbing. People often don't want to think about it, but it's so important to make sure your data is safe. If you're using Windows, which I think you are, you have backup software already built in, including imaging software. That's what the Acronis does, is it makes an image. So if you just press the Windows key and type backup, you'll see there's a variety of choices there. And frankly, in Windows 10, I'd probably just use what they come with. That's fine. Here's what I would tell you about backup software. I prefer backups that I can look at the result and see all the files. Microsoft's backup and most others make giant blobs, and I don't trust those quite as well. So when we come back, I'll talk about that. And I'll do an ad for our sponsor, because they do a good job too. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. We're talking to Stuart in Beverly Hills about backup. And he asked in particular what my favorite backup program is for Windows. And frankly, I just use Windows. But I also, Windows doesn't meet one of my key criteria, which is that I want to be able to see the tree structure as it's backed up. So, the real truth is you probably should use multiple systems, not multiple programs, but multiple systems. And the reason is you want one that's backed up right next to your computer. Because that's the near-line backup that's quick to get to. If you just, I messed up this file, you can get it right away off that hard drive. And for that, Windows backup is fine. People are mentioning Ease US. They make some free solutions that are very good, EASEUS.com. Mm-hmm. We'll put this all in the show notes. We'll put a fairly long list. There's Macrium Reflect. A lot of people like that. Mm-hmm. So there's that. There's what I like to do is I like to have a hard drive next to my computer that isn't the target of a weekly backup or something like that, but is a synchronized. So I say these are the five folders I want to always back up. Most, my documents is probably one of them. My pictures might be another one. My music might be a third. So you figure out which folders you want automatically backed up. And then you use a program. People are recommending Resilio, R-E-S-I-L-I-O, Sync, which is a very good one, to run in the background and keep the external drive folders synchronized with the internal drive folders. If you do that, there's one thing I would suggest, which is there's true synchronization, which means if I delete something on the internal drive, it will delete it on the external drive. That's not so good for backup, because you want backup for the stuff you accidentally delete. So what I would recommend is copying without copying deletions. And every one of these sync programs, there's a box somewhere that says don't sync deletions. And that's, you want to make sure that you check that. And then it is a backup solution, because essentially that external drive will have every file you've ever created on it. And it's, and because it matches my key criterion, which is I can open that folder on the external drive and look at it and say, yeah, there's the file I want, and copy it. But that's not enough by itself. You also may want to make image backups of the whole system, because you can back up your data, but it's a pain in the butt when you don't have the apps that you installed. And you may not have easy access to those disks or, you know, whatever. You want to just be able to restore it. So for that, I recommend imaging software. And there's a number of these. The one that Steve Gibson tells me I should be using, and in fact, I think I did buy it, is Drive Image XL. But there are a number of these. We'll put all of this information in the show notes. And then so that's two kinds of backup now. There's a synchronization file by file backup. There's an image backup. You only do that, really, best time to do that is when you first set up a computer, and then maybe every once in a while after major updates and changes, you want to do that. But it's not a good way to backup data, because data changes more rapidly than you're going to make image. You don't want to make an image copy all the time. That's too much work.
Right.
So you got an image copy you do periodically, quarterly, let's say. You've got real-time, constant synchronization going on. And then you want a third system, which is off-site. And this is the one that's really important. You mentioned a crash plan. That's basically what crash plan does. There are a number of companies, including our sponsor Carbonite, that do that. And what they do is very much like the synchronization software. They run in the background on your computer, but instead of copying it to a local disk, they're copying it to the cloud. And the reason you want that is like for a real disaster where you lose everything.
Right.
And I would like to have all three. In fact, I do have all three. Because then...
That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, they match different needs, right? Sometimes you just say, oh, what was that file? Oh, it's not on the hard drive. Maybe it's here. And then sometimes you say, oh, gosh, I need to change the hard drive and restore everything. That you do in conjunction with your image and your backup. And then the third one is, wow, there was a fire. I lost everything, but at least it's all safe in the cloud.
Right. Okay,
and you're going to only back up your data on that because you're backing it up over the internet. So speed is an issue. You don't want to back up too much over the internet.
You're not the operating system. Yeah, I'll do that on the...
Yeah. Not apps, not operating system. Just data that you've created.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much
for
validating my research.
Oh, good. I'm glad your research validated my thoughts. I'll give you one more link. We'll put this in the show notes, too. TechGuyLabs.com, by the way, is where those are kept. TechGuyLabs.com. My friend Peter Crow, TechGuyLabs.com.
TechGuyLabs.com, okay.
Yeah, and it's by day, so this, you know, you'll find it on today's show in hour number three, almost the last caller. My friend Peter Krog is a photographer. Photographers are obsessive about this because, you know, you take a wedding, you shoot a wedding, you can't lose those pictures. They're not going to restage the wedding for your behalf. You don't want a bridezilla at your throat. So you want to make sure that any images you take are preserved. So Peter has worked with the Library of Congress and the Association of Media Professionals to create a website called, it's a weird name, dpbestflow.org, DP Digital Photography, Best Flow as in Best Workflow, .org, dpbestflow.org. On there, he has a whole article about what he calls 3-2-1 backup, and it is kind of what we just described. If you're doing research, I would read this. It's enlightening. It gives you an idea of why you're doing these different kinds of backup, what disaster scenarios exist. One more thing, and I don't think I got this from Peter, but I always say it, is remember, it's not a backup if you delete the original. A backup implies multiple copies.
That's right, yeah.
Right? That makes sense. But I think there's a lot of people say, oh, and it's all backed up, so I'm just going to erase it now. That's not a backup.
Yeah, that's why I got the external solid-state drive as well, just to
very good
have a physical copy.
Exactly.
Well. I'm going to do the cloud copy as well and keep one on the computer.
So. That's basically 3-2-1 means three copies of everything, two different media, one in the cloud. That's in a nutshell what he's saying. Hey, thanks for the call.
Okay, be well. Thank
Take care, you. Stuart. You too. Which brings up our sponsor, Carbonite. Big part of the 3-2-1 backup solution. They're the one in the cloud. You want a cloud backup solution that's automatic. You don't have to think about it. Continuous. So you change a file, boom, it's backed up. And reliable, obviously. And I think affordable. Carbonite's all of the above. And more importantly, Carbonite has a plan for every user. Mac or PC, home or office. If you're in a business, all this gets twice as important, right? Because your data is your business. Nowadays, you lose your data, you might be out of business. Go to Carbonite.com, read up on this. They've got a great resources section on the office side with lots of white papers, including how to avoid getting bit by ransomware using Carbonite. And this is important, boy, so important these days. Carbonite.com, all kinds of plans. For a single computer, $59.99 a year. You only play, by the way, once a year. So, you know, set it and forget it. But if you've got multiple computers or servers, an office, they've got solutions for you too. And free trials of all the different plans. So go to Carbonite.com. Try it for free. No credit card needed. But do use my name, Leo, as the offer code. That way you'll get 2 months free with purchase. You got to back it up to get it back. So do it right with Carbonite. Arthur. In Maine, I think you're the last call of the day. Hi, Arthur.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for hanging on.
Yeah, awesome show, man. You're a wealth of information. Really appreciate taking my call.
I love what I do.
You can tell.
I care.
All right. I got kind of a quick two-parter for you. Number one, I'm struggling between replacing my old waterproof camera. We're going into the summer season here with camping and boating and all that stuff. So I need something that's obviously waterproof, do a lot of underwater photography, rugged. But I'm struggling between a sports action cam versus another point and shoot waterproof.
Here's what I would get. And I saw a lot of these on my trip. I think these are great. They're from Olympus. The image quality is very good. It's bigger than an action cam. The action cam, like the GoPro, is small, right. But they're very wide angle. They're really not as good for stills.
Right, that's what I was concerned about. Yeah, taking still photography.
Get the,
I
want to this
be
is
able to take good pictures.
The Olympus Tough TG5. It is a really pretty decent point and shoot. I mean, very good point and shoot. Better than a GoPro, for instance.
Right.
A little more expensive. We're going to a few hundred bucks here. But you can take it underwater. I've used it to shoot underwater. It looks beautiful.
I'm trying to keep it under a $200 budget, so I don't know.
That's a tougher price point. You can still find the older this is list price $450, which means probably around $400, $350. But you can get a TG4 or a TG3 if you shop around, and that's probably it's probably in your price range. And you know what? I don't think they really improved them that much. A little more, a few more megapixels, that's about it.
A TG3 or 4?
Yeah, just the Olympus Tough, and just get the one you can afford. Ricoh, which bought Pentax, also makes a similar camera, and I had that, the Pentax version of that. Those are very good. You might be able to find those around $200, but you're going to love those, and it's I think much more versatile than just a GoPro or some other action cam. Hey, we're out of time, but thanks for joining me. Thanks to Michael Cozier, our musical director, Kim Schaffer for answering the phones. Thanks to you for being here. I'll see you next time. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows on the Netcast Network. It's called TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on. And on. You even get your daily dose of tech news with Tech News Today. And of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guy show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.